Okay, so I do want to mention my co-authors first, Anirban Dasgupta, Kunal Panera, I'm Justin Rao, and Shanwei Wang. We did this work while we're all at Yahoo, and we've since had the Yahoo diaspora happen, and Anirban still remains. And I also would like to say, especially since it's being recorded, the opinions expressed in this talk are my own, not Microsoft's, not Yahoo, not even these guys, just mine. Facts, we'll go ahead and attribute to the authors, and I'll let you determine what's a fact and what's an opinion. But anything that ticks you off too much is an opinion. Get mad at me. Let's say that. Okay. So we'll start. So I'll start with some. So my training is in economics. My PhD is in economics. I'm sort of the most out of place person here in some sense. So if you talk to me after the talk, make sure you know that I'm an economist. I don't probably know anything what you're saying. So we'll start with some spam economics. The question we start out with, of course, is spam bad? And I think this is actually a pretty fundamental question. And if you're asking this question, you should say, well, for who? Well, for society, I've done some work with another economist that just came out in the Journal of Economic Perspectives. We estimate the social costs, the ratio of the social cost to the private returns is at least 100-1. What this is saying, a question came up after the first talk is, sort of how much are these guys making relative to how much it's costing society? In this paper, we estimate at least 100-1. Now, how high is that number? That seems pretty high. Auto theft is about 19-1. So auto theft, another form of crime, the response was, well, crime's always inefficient. That's generally true. Unless you take 20 bucks from your parents, that's pretty efficient, actually, because you probably value that more than them. But that's how economists think. Auto theft is about 19-1. What's this saying is that somehow in the process of this crime, spam is in 5 times less efficient than auto theft. Yes, when you steal a car, only 5% of the value of the car is extracted in some sense relative to the cost of incarceration, the cost of prosecution, the cost of auto insurance. Only 5% is extracted. Well, spam, only 1% is extracted relative to the cost of fighting and the time cost. What about driving a car? Driving a car is really, really efficient in comparison. The estimates are that if you took into account all the social costs, they're about 4 to 37% of the private benefits people get from driving cars. So what that would say is sort of the optimal tax on gasoline would be 4 to 37% of the benefits people get from driving. So, you know, compared to crime, you know, legal stuff is generally much more efficient, even if it has an externality associated with it. So, but back to spam. Is spam bad? Well, is burglary bad? Well, yes, it is for us, right? But burglary is definitely not bad for these guys, right? I mean, they make gated communities, security companies, and people that make bike locks benefit from a huge supply of burglars out there, right? It's important to remember that in an economy, it's not always clear what's good for who. And here, these guys, burglary's bad for everybody, and someone from ADT would say burglars are bad. That's why we're keeping you safe, right? So these companies fight burglars, and they profit from the fight. Now, here's a graph. Graphs are good. The three-firm concentration ratio for personal email. So three-firm concentration ratio in economics says, what fraction of the market do the top three firms control? It's a commonly used number. So what's this showing you? Since 2006, this is from ComScore, the three-firm concentration ratio has gone from 57% to 87%. That's saying that these three guys, these are the three firms that are concentrated, have gone from controlling roughly half the market, and if you take this line back to 2001, it's about 10%. So these three top firms have gone from controlling a relatively small fraction of the market to a relatively huge fraction of the market. One of the reasons we point to in that other paper is fighting spam has a lot of economies of scale. One obvious one is crowdsourcing. The bigger your user base, the quicker feedback you get, the better your spam filter. Other ones that are less obvious are the fact that you hire headcount engineers, you house them in a building, all these things have fixed costs. Well, competition in this case dictates protected users' inbox. This is why they're succeeding. They're protecting users' inbox, right? But it does not dictate takedown spammers, right? So these are two completely different things. Just like ADT will protect your house, it won't go out there and drive around and pull criminals off the street. That's the cop's job, right? It's a different thing. So here's some people, I think, in the spam ecosystem. And this is where the opinions are. Is it all opinion, right? Camera, all opinion. I don't want to get fired. All right. So top right, this is your ADT bike lock companies of the world, right? Clearly, they don't like spam for their users, but this is the bike locks of the world. Bottom right, your web publishers, a little less clear, right? How did Google become Google in the first place? Well, remember searching back in 1998? It was all spam, right? One of the reasons they became great was because they made search so effective. So yeah, and Google, Yahoo, and Microsoft are all big webmail providers, but Microsoft, you know, runs machines that might get infiltrated. So for these guys, spam is bad for their users, but the fact that they're great at defending against it might be good for their business. For social networking here, not a lot of competitive pressure, right? The users of these networks are just bothered by potentially spam. It's not obvious to me that the networks themselves benefit from their ability to fight it. The platform probably just hurts when it gets inundated with spam. So for these guys, I think they really, really do dislike spam unambiguously, whereas these guys, it's less clear. Email service providers, I think they really hate spam, right? They're not really benefiting from their ability to fight it, but their machines might be being compromised and sending out spam that might be turning people into mail servers. And the people that love spam the most, I think, is the U.S. Postal Service. These guys, I think, when you move, they make you sign up for catalogs, right? I mean, they literally make you do this. And I personally think that the USPS probably would not be open for business if it weren't for junk mail, right? They love junk mail because they make money off the transmission. So junk mail is bad, but it's not bad for everyone. I think it's important to keep this in mind. So what this paper does is approach these sort of questions from this economic perspective. How will economic agents react in the market when there's something bad going on? Bad for users, but not necessarily bad for them. Okay, so when we did this work at Yahoo, what we were trying to answer this question is, how much should we spend to fight spam? I think it's a very relevant question for major webmail providers. And this was actually, the purpose of this project was more of an applied science project to answer this question, not necessarily to develop a new research technique. We started with the premise that how much to spend should be proportional to how much users dislike it, because we're a profit maximizing firm. If they don't seem to dislike it, you shouldn't really worry about it too much. And we started with the question is, can we measure the causal effect of spam exposure on user engagement? So can we measure that if we counterfactually made the spam filter better, what would that deliver in terms of engagement? This is the precise question I was asked repeatedly in meetings at Yahoo. And I was also asked, what type of metrics does spam affect? So not only what kind of engagement we get, but where will engagement show up? And how do these effects evolve over time? What kind of time frame are these positive or negative effects gonna show? And from a research perspective, our goal here is to link this impact on users with how the providers operate in this market. Okay, so that's sort of the perspective we're coming from. And the question, you know, why is this important? I've tried to, you know, say why I think it's important so far, but from an economic perspective, the impact of spam on users will dictate the competitive pressure for webmail providers to fight spam. This is just something that, if basic economics is true, this statement should hold, okay? That's why, so I think studying the users is important, because it will say, in that big ecosystem of spam defenders and spam people that serve the internet, who has the incentive to really fight, and how big is that incentive? So that's another question the paper's indirectly getting at. So how do we go about estimating the causal effects of spam exposure? So ideally, we're scientists, we run experiments, we run an A/B test. Well, really, we worked at Yahoo, there's a huge amount of mail users, so we'd say we'd run a huge A/B test. But what does an A/B test really mean in this setting? Well, it means we'd spam the shit out of people, right? So that's, you know, I don't know why I put the stars on there if I was going to say the word anyway. That's poorly thought out. Right, so that the A/B test is kind of cruel in some sense. We had discussions about tweaking the spam filter by a small amount, so we're no longer doing this, we're just kind of tweaking it a little bit. The problem there is that it would give really small variation between groups. So if the underlying hypothesis is that the response to spam might be nonlinear, there might be different effects of a large increase in spam versus small increase, this sort of tweak would not get us there. So the key challenge we faced were the A/B test from a feasibility perspective and an ethical perspective, and really a profitability perspective, if it got out that this was happening, it was really not feasible. But the second key challenge is that spam exposure itself is endogenous or related to the things we care about, the engagement metrics we care about. So for most webmail providers, it's true that if you look at just a raw correlation between how much spam you get and how much you log into the webmail client, it's a positive relationship. The more spam you get, the more you log in. And of course, what's going on is probably that's your primary account. You're using that to sign up for things all over the internet. You're giving it out to your friends, and it's getting in lists to get spam. Maybe you've been a little careless with it. So spam exposure itself is related it's related to how much you use the account. So it's an endogenous variable. We'll have to keep that in mind. So to get around this, the method we use is we develop a large-scale nearest neighbor matching technique to get around this problem. And I'll show you sort of a schematic of how this is going to work, and I'll try to isolate how it's definitely not perfect. Anything that's not an experiment is not perfect, and we could be getting the answer wrong, and I'll try to speak to where the concerns really are. So how do we apply this k-nearest neighbor matching? We're actually going to match people to one person, so it's one nearest neighbor. How do we apply this to the spam setting? Well, we take a time period of usage on Yahoo Mail, and we take a certain period, we talk at the start called the matching period, and we try to match two users that look like they're engaging with the client in almost exactly the same way. Hopefully we're getting two people that in terms of their observable behavior look very, very similar. In the sort of period right after matching, we're gonna look at the exposure to spam. We're gonna hope that within that pair, we do see some differences we can hope to identify a causal effect with. And then in a period following exposure, we look at impact down the road, and we try to extend that as long as we meaningfully can with the signal we have in the data. So in our study, we have 2 months of matching. We look at 1 month of exposure, and then we track the user impact for 3 months. And the matching is done, I think, importantly, the reason we use 2 months is that we did it for both the level of usage and the trend in usage. So we do this, we have a lot of words on this slide. We have these features per user per day over 2 months. So we have their daily usage of all these features, which I'll read out in a second. The idea is try to get, not only does the level matter, your current level of usage certainly would matter, in comparing users, but also are you trending up or down? If we don't control for the trend, we might get some spurious correlation involved. So what features do we match users on? We have all the mail you receive, the mail we classify as spam, the stuff you send, stuff you can compose, reply, forward, how much time you spend, how much pages you have on Yahoo Mail and the Yahoo site, and do you do things like delete without reading emails, might be an indicator of how much spam is in your inbox already, deleting mails in general, and are you voting you have spam in your inbox, or you're voting that you have not spam in your spam box. So these are the metrics we use to match users. And so, you know, reminder of the timeline, within a pair of users, once we match on these variables over a 2 month period of time, hoping to get both the level and the trend correct, we need that exposure is now going to be exogenous. What's this saying? Saying conditional on these, let's say on the ideal case, conditional on these metrics being the same over a 2 month period of time, the differences we see in your spam exposure are due to randomness alone. They're due to chance. They're exogenous to your user activity. If this assumption holds, every estimate we see is perfectly valid. Insofar as it fails, the estimates will be biased. There's, I think, two ways it could fail. One is sort of we don't observe user intent. User intent's a latent variable we don't observe. One intent could be, I'm going to trash this account. If you're going to trash this account, you might give it out to all sorts of sign-up lists and all sorts of things like that, and you know later that you're just going to like relegate it to second-tier status. You're going to get a new email account or a new alias that you're going to use on first-tier status. That would tend to say higher spam is going to be correlated with lower usage in the future, not because spam is bad, but because of the account trashing intent. Hopefully, we'll be able to identify account trashing intent with your behavior leading up to that, but if we couldn't. Another one is the intent to make this account primary. So if this is precisely the opposite. If I'm going to have the intent to make this account primary, I might intend to use this account more in the future, and I, again, give it out to more legitimate sources, but does get leaked. And here I'd had the correlation be spam would lead to more positive usage. So the bias could go either way. It's important to keep that in mind. Hopefully, with the 2 months of detailed matching, we get around that. But I'm just going to outline that there still could be some remnant bias. To try to work against this bias, we required the Euclidean distance between matches to be less than 0.1. There's about 100 million active Yahoo Mail users in the United States. And so we tried to search over this huge space, and the paper has the details, to try to get really tight matches. We tried to clean out outliers, accounts that looked like they were taken over by bots, things like this. And we required bi-directional matches. So what I mean here is that think of like in elementary school, your best friend might not be best friends with you, right? So your nearest neighbor match might not be, you might not be their nearest neighbor. Requiring bi-directional matches helps in two ways. One, it means we found that actually you might induce some bias if you don't require this, because you might have someone that, like the popular kid in school that has a lot of nearest neighbors, but he's a little different in some way, and you don't observe that. And so we saw these sort of things happening, which worried us that these highly matched individuals were in somehow having high leverage in the results. And this is a poor property. This is a general weakness or a general concern in matching estimators. So the final sample, we have 486,000 and change pairs of users, so a million humans. And I'll refer you to the paper for the methodology of actually creating these huge amount of matches, doing it at scale. I'll refer you to the paper there, partly because I frankly just don't know how that works. I'm an economist. Okay, results. First step, we have to quantify spam exposure. We observe classified spam. Classified spam ends up in your spam box. That probably doesn't annoy you at all, right? So we observe the thing we know doesn't annoy you. So we have to infer spam exposure, which is spam in the inbox, from classified spam. So our first step in analysis is to estimate the false negative rate of the then Yahoo's spam classifier for that period of time. Then, and this is, I think, an innocuous assumption for the main bulk of the analysis, we have to assume the false negative rate is constant within a pair. What's that basically saying? It's saying the spam filter doesn't work differentially better conditional on all those variables within a pair of users. The good thing is the spam filter uses all those variables and doesn't use more than that to classify. So it sort of can't, this sort of has to hold. But if we try to compare different demographics, like old users versus young users or new users versus old users, then this assumption probably won't hold. A new user might have a better spam filter than an old user or vice versa. So we have to keep that in mind. But for the bulk analysis, this should be fine. And we won't reveal to you how well we thought the Yahoo spam filter was doing. We'll just present the results in spam in the inbox space. So when I say a piece of spam, it's saying an estimated piece of spam in your inbox. We won't say how many spams the spam box we think that corresponded to. So the first step, we'll look at user engagement as a function of delta S, which is delta S is the difference in spam exposure between users. Within a pair of users, beforehand they had the same spam exposure by the matching procedure. In the exposure period, spam exposure differed. Sometimes it was really close, sometimes it was a big difference. And we'll look at, in that pair of users, how does engagement differ between the more exposed user and the less exposed user? And delta S will give the difference in spam exposure between those users. Oh, I just said that. Okay. The first table, I don't know if you can see this. This table is essentially to demonstrate one thing. Every estimate of the spam exposure variable for everything we have from page views to logins is negative. This makes sense, right? This is a sanity check in some sense. The more exposed user had lower engagement on every metric we study. Now, what does 0.472 male page views mean to you? Well, not a lot. To Yahoo, it means a certain amount of money, right? That's saying for every piece of spam in the inbox, the more exposed user had about half, one half of a page view less. The page view is actually the most monetizable, short-run monetizable metric we have up there because Yahoo had a pretty good idea of how much each mail page view is worth based on the total value of ads in that page. 24 seconds, you know, hard to know what to make of that. Let's look at these numbers as a function of the a percentage of their monthly averages, okay? And in a second, we'll go through some nonlinear effects. The means might not be so informative, but what I'll go through is that for things that correspond with reading mail, the effect of one piece of mail in the spam box was about 1% of monthly usage. It was higher for things that have to do with sending mail. However, the base frequency of these activities are much different. People read about 50 times or 30, 40 times more mail than they actually send. People generally don't send that much mail. They're reading lots of things like Facebook updates and flight reminders and things like this. They're sending far, far less. And you don't have to log into the account that often, so the logins shows the smallest effect. We'll talk about that. What I'll note is that the effects seem highest for volitional activities and lowest for responsive activities. So if you look at sent mail, the composed mails, the effect was 2.5%. For replying, it was only 1%. And for forwarding, it was 1%, but that's a very low frequency event. So the total sent effect was 2.2%. Most of that's coming through compositions. So composing a mail is when you press, I'm going to write a new email to someone. That's a very volitional activity. If you're looking at moving away from an account, that's probably the first thing that's going to go. And actually, composing mails is a great long-term predictor of engagement a year down the road. We found that in other work. And then responsive activities, things like reading and stuff like this, this is people still sending you mail, shows a lower initial effect. The question, of course, like I said, in terms of competitive pressure, is going to be, what does the effect look like by exposure level? And we see that it's quite nonlinear. We're looking at the dark line here is page views, the squares are sent mail, and the circles are logins, and they have different axes because of the different base rates. We see here on the x-axis, zero starts out with, within the pair of users, they had the exact same spam exposure in the exposure period, and then it takes it out to 30. 30 is about where 99% of the data lies. And we'll see is that for small differences or small increases in my spam exposure, the effects are very muted. In fact, you can't reject at zero for one or two. This is per month, one or two per month. So about one every 15 days, you literally, it's this negative effect. The point estimate's negative, but it's very, very small. So tiny increases, there's relatively small increase in spam, does not affect engagement in the mail client very much at all. But what we see is that around 15 to 18, this is about, for medians, this is about once per login. So at about once per login, we see a tipping point of the effect really, really ticking up and getting very, very negative. So that corresponds maybe with intuition about how people use it. If it's showing up frequently enough to affect me almost every day, every time I log in, the effect turns very, very negative. If it's showing up twice a month, it's really not going to affect my engagement, at least on the time period we're seeing. It's negative, but it's much more muted. So from a provider perspective, you have an incentive to make sure no user gets flooded, but if a small tick up spread across a lot of people is much better for you than a big tick up concentrated on one person with the nonlinear effects. How does this effect evolve over time? So in this graph, we're looking at sent mail is the gray line. Composed mail, of a fraction of sent mail is composed, is the triangle blues, and the plus black line is red mail. This is how the effect knocks on over time. So the left hand is 1 month effect, the middle is 2 month effect 2 months out, and the right is effect 3 months out. This is the additional effect. So if this line is still below zero, it's saying there's a continued effect. It all doesn't happen in the first month. So what do we see here? For sent and composed mail, we estimate the effect happens, and then there's a new level, and it stops. So it persists in the future, but it doesn't increase over time. This is what this graph is saying. For sent and composed, those volitional activities, it happens right away, and then it continues, but it doesn't persist and increase. For the more reactive activities, for reading mail, we see that the effect happens, and then it increases, at least over the three-month time we saw it, the negative effect was still increasing in the cumulative terms. And what this means is that the cumulative effect for these responsive actions, we see across responsive actions, catches up to the volitional actions. Volitional action happens right away. Responsive actions make sense. It takes a little longer to adjust. So this is all consistent with the negative effect, and it's consistent with how people use the client. The last result I'll talk about is something we were asked at Yahoo about all the time, and that's contagion effects. And the contagion effect might be called a brand loss effect. So you start getting spam in your Yahoo Mail client. How do you use Yahoo Finance or Yahoo.com? Can we measure a statistically significant spillover or brand loss effect? So the first column I'll show you is that this is the effect on Yahoo page views that are not in the mail.yahoo.com domain. Okay? So the contagion effect estimate we see is about 0.06 page views per spam and about 4 seconds per spam. This is not conditioning on the effect of mail behavior. So the thing about Yahoo Mail is it has a search bar and it has news stories. So if we condition on Yahoo Mail behavior, we say, let's condition this behavior on how much they actually use Yahoo Mail. We see the effect is going away. The pure effect is going away. It's about 1/4. What's this saying? There is an externality. There is an additional effect on Yahoo, but it seems to be driven by the fact that people are using Yahoo Mail less. It doesn't seem to be due to the fact they're actually volitionally going to Yahoo.com or Yahoo Finance less. It seems that there's less clicks through the Yahoo Mail to these other sites. So are there mechanical spillovers? There's fewer clicks. There's fewer other site page views based on mechanical spillovers. There are. Is there a brand loss effect? It's small, and in this sample, not statistically significant. It was about 1/4 of the total effect. So it really is a number that didn't get people excited in business meetings. I'll tell you, 0.06 page views is not really turn the dial. But it was there. It just wasn't significant. Got it. So I'll skip the user characteristic analysis because I think it's pretty, the assumption of false negative rate might not hold. So the spam supply chain, as I started out, is heavily studied. And I've listed some papers here that have been in this conference and others. And the purpose of this paper is that the email service provider side is not as well understood. And our paper helps fill this void. Methodologically, we attempted to describe a large-scale nearest neighbor matching technique that's appropriate when A/B testing is not feasible or ethical. So the real challenge here was that we couldn't use our preferred hammer. And we, in the paper, although I didn't talk about it, we demonstrate the advantage of this technique in this setting over similar techniques like propensity score matching. And the main advantage here is we're matching on the attributes themselves and not trying to model exposure. And here, exposure is not a binary variable, which is usually true in PSM techniques. And for practitioners, the method is particularly suited to measuring the effects of online abuse and large data where matching can be tight. That's why it works well. And so in conclusion, I think a weakness of this study is that the sign of the effect we study is obvious. Spam is bad for users. It's not bad for Yahoo necessarily, but it's bad for users. The magnitude of the effect was not, so that's for business perspective, the magnitude was not. The nonlinearity, the approximately once per login, that nonlinearity was not obvious. The temporal decay of volitional versus response activities was not obvious to us, as I just said. And the purpose of this study in terms of an applied science paper was trying to replace intuition, which is spam is bad, with quantitative estimates of the causal effects to try to put a number to try to guide investment for the email service provider. Okay, that's all I have, and I've included some examples of spam for your pleasure.
Okay, thanks, Justin. We have time for a few questions. I'm going to ask the first one. Just could you return to that question you posed in the very beginning? I think it was to the effect of,
I'll get there. Keep talking.
I believe it was to the effect of how much effort do you need to put into protecting against spam, or sort of how much
sure.
is enough?
Sure. Well,
I don't quite recall the all the conditions.
Sure, yeah. So for these email service providers, I think the discussion at Yahoo, you know, I mean, for any email service provider, you want to be the best, right? So it's going to be a competitive market. But the question is, if you are slightly better in a market, the amount of market share you'll capture by being slightly better will be proportional to how much users care about that object. So if it's money and you're 2 cents better at making toothpaste, you're not going to capture all the market because people aren't responsive to that small change in price. That's just not enough of a dollar value. And so the goal of the study was saying, if people respond drastically to small change in spam exposure, that would say the competitive pressure is very strong. Being slightly better will get someone to switch email clients. Switching email clients probably takes an hour or 2 hours of your life. So the question is, how much do they dislike it? From Yahoo's perspective, it was, and what we do see in this data is we do see quitting. And so the question was, if we're this far away from Google, how bad is that going to be for us in the long run? That was the real question. If users are really have a flat function around small changes, then being, you know, in that region away from Google is going to have a small effect. If users have a really steep function in the area we're at, then we're in a really precarious position in the market. And that was in terms of a competitive pressure for Yahoo. Now, for the industry leader, the question is, if you're leading the industry, you probably have no incentive on the margin, but in expectation, you have an incentive because everyone's fighting it too, right? Because Microsoft might come out something better, right? So you, with uncertainty, you'd still have that incentive. But it's a complicated issue. Opinions.
Okay. I'm not sure who is first, so we'll go into the front. Name and affiliation, please.
Hi, Chris Kanish, University of Illinois, Chicago. This is spectacular stuff. I really enjoy it. I have a question about your methodology. So what I saw about that, it seems really, really interesting that you don't have to use these A-B tests, that you can use this K-nearest neighbor, sure. and that works out great. But one other thing I noticed is that you were at Yahoo Mail, and you had 100 million American active users.
Yeah.
What were your, like, at what tipping point do you have enough users, enough activity to be able to have statistically significant, conclusions from this data?
So like, we piloted this with 30, with searching over, say, sampling 2 million and searching for matches over 2 million people. And that got us tight matches for, say, 35,000 pairs, tight enough that we were good with it. And that got us statistically significant, but not overwhelming and not something to really act on. And then we redid it, searching over everyone and getting the tight pairs. Another methodology we talked about in the paper. A worry with any matching techniques is that people you can match are different than people you can't. Think of like a job training program. In job training matching, what you're doing is saying, I'm going to predict you're very likely to get training, but you didn't, and I'm going to match someone to you that did get training. Well, there might be something kind of weird about you that you were very likely to get training, but you didn't, right? And you might get matched with a lot of people. You might have high leverage. So we did worry about that and tried to ascertain that our matched people demographically looked like our unmatched people. But it helped having a huge sample of unmatched people to verify this. So I'd say for this methodology really has a huge advantage for a big provider. For if you're small time, I would trust it much less. I think the tight matching really helped me at least think that we got it right. Yeah.
Thanks a lot. Alex Radice, Google. I'm curious if the effect of how well other email providers are doing at spam would impact your results. For instance, if a user on Yahoo is getting one spam email per day, but in Gmail they're getting 3 spam emails per day, that might make them more likely to use Yahoo, even though they're getting spam there.
Right. So hopefully, I agree. You know, a variable we'd love to have in our regressions is not only the false negative classification efficiency of Yahoo, but also of every competitor. Hopefully, for the validity of these results, within a pair of users we study, over the time period we study, their outside option was similar. That would be the kind of assumption you're maintaining, which is untestable. But it certainly should really, really matter, that variable. In terms of the competitive pressure switching, how aware are other users of what they can get? That's going to really dictate competitive pressures also. We have sort of one angle on it, but not the whole picture. That's a really good point. Thanks for pointing that up.
Brad Hill, PayPal. I found your choice of Yahoo Mail really interesting in that Yahoo Mail is one of the only large webmail providers I've used, though not recently, that sends advertisements to users as emails that are basically, from the user's point of view, indistinguishable from spam.
Yeah.
So I think I have two related questions from that. Was there simply no appetite to do A/B testing with that portion of the spam stream? And B, do you think that that biases your results because people like me who are spam sensitive have long ago just stopped using Yahoo Mail because we hate those advertisements as emails so much that the sensitive users have already fled the platform?
Yeah, so I'll address the second question first. Do we have a selected sample of users that maybe didn't migrate to another platform because they were getting spam? So especially that really flat portion of the nonlinear function might be less flat for a user of a different mail provider that's shown that they'll move if they get any sort of spam. So could be some selection effects there. You know, we chose Yahoo because we were working there. That seemed to make sense to us. In terms of doing an A/B test with Yahoo mail marketing, hard for two reasons. One is that internally, those are sort of considered very expensive forms of advertisements. So the internal like CPM we place on those is really high. So the test would have rated out as very expensive. And secondly, we would have not been very popular guys if we said, by the way, this stuff you're doing, I mean, it might have been useful to the business, but this is, you have to keep this in mind working in that business. You can only piss like 10% of people off.
Yes.
Hi, Amir Rahmati, UMass. You had a chart describing the percentage of market the top two providers have.
True.
And there was a dip in 2010. Can you
talk to ComScore about it? I don't know. You know, we got this data from ComScore that has this dip. This is also March of every year. It's not, you know, it's just one reporting period, March of every year. ComScore provides this to major web mail providers. This happened. Is it real or is it an artifact of the data? I don't know. If you just fit a linear function in here, you would just interpolate that point up to exactly where it would be between the other two points. So I don't make a lot of this 2010 dip. Maybe they changed the way they were recording data. I don't make a lot of it. But if you go back to 2001, you see a ton of small people with webmail. And if you go to 2012, you see three providers and a tail. And that's the main difference. That is distinct in the data. But for that, for the short term, I can't say specifically. But I think clearly over the long term, the trend is clear.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
Great.